All right, we are in week four of our sermon series where we are going through the Sermon on the Mount. If you were here last week, you know I got really into salt, being the salt of the earth. So that means I have a little bit more to cover today than I had originally planned. So we are going to dig right into this. Matthew 5, 17. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have come not to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one letter, not one stroke of a letter will pass from the law until all is accomplished. So I think we can see the main thrust of this is pretty clear. Right? Jesus is saying he's not negating his Jewish faith. Right? He was a reformer within his tradition, and he wanted the people listening to him to know that he wasn't telling them to ignore the Jewish law, but that he was offering his own rabbinical interpretation of it. Right, so when we talk about the Jewish law, we're talking about the first five books of the Bible, right? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Leviticus, Ken's new favorite book, right? First five books of the Bible is also called the law. It's sometimes called the Torah. It's called the five books of Moses. It's called the law of Moses. All of these things are talking about the same thing. All largely refer to it as Torah, and that's what I'm talking about. So it is likely that Jesus had memorized the Torah by about the age of 12, as boys were commonly expected to do in his time. And so I think it's helpful for us to understand just how deeply rooted he would have been in those stories of those first five books, and how deeply rooted the people who were out there listening to him as he was giving this teaching, they also would have known these stories, and so they would have understood some of the context of what he was doing. So this bit about fulfilling the law, it's not just kind of stuck willy-nilly into the sermon. The sermon itself is reflecting on and interacting with those first five books. So a little over a year ago, I did a pretty long sermon series on something called Original Blessing. We won't go too far into that, but we were looking at that largely just looking at the larger narrative arc of those first five books of the Bible. And we talked about how the general structure of the Torah narrative is blessings, pitfalls, guidelines, choice. Don't worry, there won't be a test. It ends with a choice, life or death. Right? So it starts with blessings, right? It tells the humans, you've been blessed by God, go and be a blessing. This is your purpose in the world, that God has blessed you, and here are some ways that you can thrive and go out and bring that repair into all of creation. Now watch out for the pitfalls that keep you from thriving and keep you from being everything that you're made to be. And the way those pitfalls are described are through a whole series of stories, because it was mostly an oral tradition at that point, so people would memorize these stories and pass them on, and that was the way that people could, you know, like talk about these different pitfalls, these very deep parts of our human nature, right? These common ways that we humans make our own lives harder. Stories about murder and jealousy and violence and unbridled empire and lying and mistreating our loved ones. When I was a kid, I loved the stories from the Old Testament because I was like, these have intrigue. These have a lot going on, right? So you've got all these stories, and then those are followed by sort of general guidelines for daily living, right? That's a lot of Leviticus. These are meant to help humans develop a framework for how they could live more justly in their families and in their communities. And then Torah, those first five books, wraps up with a choice in Deuteronomy 30. God says, I've set before you life and death, blessings and curses, right? Tree of life, tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now choose life so that you and your children might live and that you might love the Lord your God and listen to his voice and hold fast, right? He's trying to say, embrace the wise choices. It'll go better for you. So Jesus is mirroring this structure in the Sermon on the Mount. Right, so he opens with blessings, right? Blessed are the poor, blessed are the meek, blessed are the peacemakers, right? Remember we went through that. And we looked at how that word blessed there is more aptly translated, happy are they. Because what Jesus was doing is he was talking to a whole bunch of people who I think he suspected didn't think that they were part of this blessing, right? This is part of their story, their tradition, and they're just kind of thinking, I don't count in this because I'm too poor, I'm too sad. Maybe I don't have enough sort of authority to operate in a way that I can make any difference. And so he's going along, and he looks at them, and he's saying, happy are you, because God is already at work among you. Don't discount yourselves. That's actually where God is at work often, is among the people who feel like they're discounted from this work. how happy you must be. God is at work. You're part of this. There's nothing you can do to earn it. And then Jesus follows this up with a few things that trip humans up, which we're going to get to today. And then we'll see in a couple of weeks that Jesus moves on to some guidelines for shaping our character, and then he ends his sermon with a choice, life or death. See, there's two roads, there's two gates, there's two houses. Choose one, right? Choose life. Things will go better for you. So this here, we understand Jesus is a Jewish rabbi, and he's giving a commentary on the Torah, right? He's condensing it down, and he came not to abolish it, but to fulfill it, like to try and help, like move some things along in that conversation. So if he's mirroring this general structure, then we're here on the parts that trip us up. And because he's doing it in like what is now less than a chapter and not in stories of five books, he's just boiling it down to like the most significant things that get us into trouble. And he's talking about them in general, like these are the cycles that humans find themselves in, right? Mistreating people with whom we're in intimate relationships, murder, or maybe violence in our intimate relationship or in our closer relationships, lying and violence. And Daniel will look at violence next week, which means I get murder, adultery, divorce, and lying. So before I look at those, I do want to just assure you, if you've got a little pit in your stomach, maybe some of these things are part of your story. I'm somebody who's had the Bible weaponized against me, and so I am hyper aware of how these verses have been used to harm or to shame some of you. I know for absolute certain some of you stayed in abusive or very bad marriages far longer than was healthy because of how this was applied by faith leaders in your life. And so I just want to acknowledge that up front. I'm not even going to read the part about divorce, actually. But I just want to say, I know they sometimes land hard without context, so just give me a little bit of trust here as we unpack things. I am not here to throw stones. Matthew 5:21. You've heard it said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder. And whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you, if you're angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you will be liable to the council. And if you say, you fool, you will be liable to the hell of fire. So when you're offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother or sister, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you're on the way to court with him, or your accuser might hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and then you'll be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will never get out until you've paid the last penny. All right, so the first thing I want to clear up is this stuff about hell, because I think that can get a little bit distracting, right? So we just read, Jesus says, you will be liable to the hell of fire. In the next little section, you will hear him say a couple of times, your whole body will be thrown into hell. So say, he is not saying, if you get mad, you're going to burn with eternal torment. And I think that's how we often hear it in the West. That isn't what he is saying. The Greek word that's translated hell here is Gehenna. And Gehenna was a literal place. It's a valley just outside the walls of Jerusalem. I like to tell people, I ate at a very fine restaurant in hell. The Valley of Gehenna is a lovely part of town in Jerusalem today. But in Jesus's day, it was the trash dump. It's where the garbage was put and set on fire. It's where the wild dogs would go roaming around looking for scraps. It wasn't a nice place. It smelled bad. It was dangerous. It was on fire. So when Jesus says you could be liable to the hell of fire, the Gehenna of fire, he's just saying there could be unpleasant consequences if you say, call someone a fool to their face in public, right? You might want to consider the ramifications before you go running your mouth. Dr. Glenn Stassen, who I think has done the best work on the Sermon on the Mount, I'm just going to recommend the book. I don't usually rely quite so heavily, but man, he was my ethics professor, Living the Sermon on the Mount. You can buy it used online. It has a really hokey cover, but if you're interested in learning more, I think that one's really good. He says this framework, when we're talking about anger here, it's not, you heard it said not to murder, so now I'm going to up the ante and tell you you can't even get mad. Right? It's not a rules-based ethic that's going on here. It's not trying to like make goals that are harder and harder for people to keep. He says Jesus is looking at the main cycles that keep humans from living well and then diagnosing the root of that cycle and then offering practical actions to help break the cycle. This part you will want to remember. The problem, the diagnosis, the practical action. Problem, diagnosis, practical action. It's in the notes. This is Jesus' contribution to this part of Torah. He's adding a pastoral element of practical tools to help people live better lives, right? So the first problem we just read is murder. Or he takes it, you know, says also it could be getting sued or getting put in jail. The diagnosis of the cycle that leads to these sorts of ends is uncontrolled anger. Now, Jesus is not saying you should never be angry, right? Jesus was angry many times in the Gospels. He called people names in public. He did the thing that he's saying. Brood of vipers, fools, hypocrites, children of hell. Try that out at your next work meeting. Yeah. Children of hell. He gets mad when people are upset that he healed someone on the Sabbath. He gets furious with the money changers in the temple. Right? He goes and overturns their tables. The part of the story that always sticks out to me is he made a whip. John 2, making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the cattle. I think the whip was probably for the animals. But if you can imagine him sitting there, like braiding the whip, like that's some anger, right? That's some anger he's sitting in. There is not a command here to not be angry. What he's getting at is more like what Paul says in Ephesians 4, which says, in your anger, do not sin. Right? Not don't be angry. Everybody gets angry sometimes. We get angry at injustice. There's lots of reasons to be angry. But in your anger, do not sin. Right? So the problem comes when we sit in the anger and we let it fester and we obsess over it. I'll date myself here, but it reminds me of that old rom-com, French Kiss. Meg Ryan, Kevin Kline. Right? Meg Ryan looks at Kevin Kline and she sees he's growing bitter and she's like, fester, fester, fester. Rot, rot, rot. That's what we're talking about here. When you find yourself festering, that's when we're heading toward trouble, and we should be wary of that. And so the practical action that Jesus recommends is go talk to the person you're mad at. Right? It's not terribly profound, but it is amazing to me how many people will go to great lengths to not talk about conflict. But we know not talking about conflict leads to damaged relationships. And so he says, go, be reconciled. Do it as soon as possible, ASAP, now. And it's not like universal advice, right? He's not trying to say this is the case and every time you're angry, it has to be done immediately. What he's doing is he's conveying urgency, right? Sometimes reconciliation isn't possible. If the other person doesn't want to be reconciled, you can't reconcile. Sometimes getting over anger can take a really long time. Especially if you've been betrayed, right? If you've been on the other end of a deep betrayal, that can take years. I can say that from personal experience, that's a process. But he's conveying the urgency of this. He's underscoring that things tend to get worse, not better, if you avoid talking about it, right? So he's just naming some worst case scenarios. Right, you could end up murdering somebody. You could get sued. You could end up in jail. So just cut off the issue, like go deal with it and talk about it so that you don't fester. The next cycle that Jesus addresses is mistreating people, especially people with whom we're in an intimate relationship. I think this isn't meant to like heap condemnation on us, but to encourage us to treat people more justly and with dignity as best we're able, and that we owe that, especially to people that we're intimate with, because there's nowhere that we're more vulnerable and more open to being hurt. All right, Matthew 5:27. You've heard that it was said, you should not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go into hell. So I think we understand the general problem. Jesus' diagnosis of this like root cycle is to objectify people. Right? He says the problem is looking at with lust. Now, this might not be the only thing, but this is the one that he's offering here. And so Glenn Stassen, he says, Jesus' diagnosis, looking with lust, is a desire to possess, an intention to dominate, and that then inflames coveting desire, right? So remember, at that time, too, women were property, and there was also a power issue at play often here. So I want to say also, this is not about having moments of desire for intimacy. I'll be a little cagey in case there's some kids in the area, right? It's not about fantasies. We are all human. I think it's just like getting angry in itself is not bad, right? Everybody has anger. Almost everybody has physical desire. I grew up in the purity culture of the religious right, of the conservative era of the 80s and 90s, right? And they would make you feel bad about any little thought or any little feeling you had. And so I would say, if you grew up with that, be free, right? I think that level of repression is not good for people, speaking very, very personally, right? But like with anger, the problem isn't the anger itself, it's the uncontrolled obsession, right? It's the way that thoughts can consume us to the point of impacting our current relationships. It's the way our thoughts can start us objectifying others. And often if we're obsessing over someone, especially if they're off the market, or you're off the market, or you're both off the market, right? The fantasy isn't about the actuality of the relationship, right? If you actually get with the person, the actuality, at least after the beautiful beginning, right, is often messy and painful and really complicated. That's where it inevitably heads. So Jesus says, you want to be wary of this. Just be wary. And maybe obviously if one or both of you is off the market and you've got something going on, you're not being honest with people who probably deserve your honesty. Right, that we need to treat them with dignity and not objectify them or treat them as immaterial in that. So Jesus isn't getting into all the nuances of possible situations, right? He knows humans are messy, things are complicated. But saying if you do find yourself obsessing about someone in ways that don't honor the fullness of that person, you're in danger of causing yourself some drama. So the practical action, he says, is to tear out your own eye or to cut off your own hand. Right? And we know, this is, to be very clear, hyperbole, right? There is no one I am aware of in Christian history who's ever interpreted that part literally, even the literalists. It's almost like if dealing with anger was urgent, right? He says, leave your gift at the altar and go see them. He's just conveying like an immediacy to it. If that was urgent, this one is that much more urgent, right? This is like all caps urgent. Jesus is saying, you need to do whatever drastic thing you need to do to minimize this cycle of objectification or lust. And if that means blocking a person on your phone, do it. If it means you need to rearrange your friend group, do it. If it means you need to look for a new job to separate yourself, do it. Right? It's drastic measures time. Now, I'm not even going to read the divorce passage, but I will say, I think the New Testament scholar, Rabbi Amy Jill Levine, I think she's right when she points out that Jesus was engaging in a very specific rabbinical argument about marriage that was like one of the hot button issues of his day. And it's an argument that honestly isn't that helpful or relevant for us. And I agree with her conclusion, which is far too many people have been trapped in loveless or abusive marriages because of a narrow reading of the gospel passages. The message of the text is one of peace, not war. It speaks of the Christian home as the model of the love between Christ and the church. Christian marriages that do not offer this model are perhaps not those that need remain forever. Right? Nobody likes divorce. It's always harder than we think it'll be, especially for kids. We know marriage, the understanding of marriage varies by time and by place. And so I'd say we use like situational ethics to help us make the best decisions we can, right? In other words, it's like case by case. You're trying to figure out the best way forward. And it's just not always clear or easy. Right? We know that in Christianity, marriage is a covenant. It's a sacrament in the church, and that when we're able to keep it, there's real riches to that. But I think our God is realistic and compassionate. Right? Came to earth to help us understand, or to help understand what it is to be human. right? So he's dealing with Torah. He's looking at these big things, and he's not looking at it and being like, you need to do all these things better. He's looking at it, and he's like, oh man, being human is hard. Let me find the hardest parts of being human, and we're going to do some of these things, and let me just offer some ways to help, right? He's like being very realistic, not judgmental in this, right? He's meeting us where we're at and just saying, this will help your life, right? This will hopefully help make your life go a little bit better. So the last bit we'll hit here is oaths, Matthew 5, 33 to 37. Again, you've heard it said to those of ancient times, you shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows that you've made to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it's the throne of God, or by earth, for it's his footstool, or by Jerusalem, or by the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. I wish I could, because man, I would love a streak of white hair, but that's a different thing. I'm getting a couple. It was kind of good. Let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything more than this comes from the evil one. Right? So I think we get by now what Jesus is doing here. The problem is falsely swearing oaths or saying that you're going to do things that you're not going to do, especially in the name of God. That isn't something we tend to do quite so often these days. The diagnosis of the helpful cycle is just like, it's lying. And especially if you're using God's name, you're not just playing fast and loose with the truth for your own gain, but you're doing it as a representative of God's presence. So you're also falsely representing God to others. And he just says the practical action to interrupt this cycle, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Say what you mean and mean what you say. Right? If you say you're going to go to your friend's dinner party next week, like let them know if you can't. Otherwise, show up. Right? Just be true to your word. I would say like one of Ken and I's little stickler things with churches has always been, I've always been like, you know, churches that don't like ordain women or don't ordain LGBTQ people or won't do gay marriages, just say it. And I've always used this, like, let your yes be yes and your no be no, right? Especially when we first started, like, I would just hear so many stories. Like, we had somebody come and they were like, we went into this big mega church in town and we said, hey, we are a married gay couple and, you know, how do you feel about that? And they're like, oh, we welcome everybody. We love everyone. We don't judge anybody. You are welcome to be part of our community. So they attend for 2 years. They're giving their money for 2 years. And then they go to volunteer to teach Sunday school. And they're like, oh, no, you can't teach our kids. And then they end up here like, no, just, it's better off. I would rather you just say, yeah, we don't do that. You know, I want to know so I can make my own decisions, right? Let your yes be yes and your no be no. So those are Jesus's practical applications for us. Talk out, go talk to somebody you're mad with. Cut off anything that's like a big temptation that might like really cause you a lot of drama. And just be true to your word, right? Those are pretty, they seem simple, but maybe sometimes hard to do. All right, so with that, we got through the hardest part of the Sermon on the Mount, I think, today. So well done. I know that one's a little bit heavier here. We'll head into a time of meditation. We often do guided meditation or a little bit of quiet. And I think we'll do some silence, but I would offer this question to you if you want to pose it before God. Is there someone that you might benefit from like having a conversation with them because you're angry? Or maybe there's just something else that the Spirit has highlighted in your heart this morning. And let's just spend a little moment letting the Holy Spirit talk to us in those spaces. Come, Lord Jesus. So Jesus, I just ask that you would guide us in wisdom as we go through our coming weeks here, especially this week ahead of us. Give us wisdom so that we make decisions that help us thrive and to live the best lives that we can live, and that we can be fruitful in our own families, in our communities, in our jobs, in our schools, that we can really reflect the presence and peace that you came to give to us. Amen.